This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. This year's primary elections kept both North Carolinians and others across the country up until the wee hours of the night. Many eyes on our state. GOP race for the U.S. Senate was number one. State House Speaker Tom Tillis won. That wasn't a big surprise, but the question was, could he gain enough votes to avoid a runoff? He did. There were important congressional races as well, and a state Supreme Court race that received more attention than usual. We'll try to sort it out today. Rob Christensen is the chief political writer for the News and Observer. Rob, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Michael Bitzer is a professor of political science at Catawba College. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
And Susan Roberts is a professor of political science at Davidson College. Susan Roberts,
Hi.
Welcome. Hi, good to have you.
Thank you.
So let's start talking about one of the biggest races, at least the race that had the most attention, the GOP race for the U.S. Senate. Michael, let's start with you. Give us your thoughts on Tom Tillis's victory.
It certainly was a victory, and we had been, you know, thinking that he was close to, if not a little bit above, that 40% threshold to avoid a summer runoff. He certainly made it convincing with a 45% victory, but again, we have to realize that only 15% statewide of the voters participated. So I think it's going to be incumbent on Tillis to certainly take the momentum out of this primary, seek to rally and consolidate his Republican base. Even though 55% of the voters did not vote for him, I think they would be very willing to support him going into the fall, but he needs to make the pitch to the various wings within the Republican Party, social evangelical conservatives, and particularly Tea Party activists, to get them energized and mobilized, and indeed say that the general campaign has started today.
Well, Susan, 55% of the voters who turned out didn't vote for him. Over 80% didn't even turn out. What do you make of the turnout, and is there anything about that that plays a role in the general election?
Tom Tillis would love the same turnout in the general election in November, but I think turnout in a primary is based, as you probably know, and our panelists would agree, on super partisan individuals, higher socioeconomic, and they're the people that are going to be kind of the referendum on the party. And I think they looked at Tillis and they said, we can elect, he can beat Kate Hagan. I think it was electability, experience. I think they voted with their hearts or heads rather than their hearts. And I also think, too, that Tom Tillis had the air wars. I don't know about the ground wars. And that's what the Republicans are going to have to really step up when it comes to November in terms of encouraging turnout.
Rob, this was billed as a battle over the hearts for the heart and soul of the Republican Party establishment versus Tea Party, and some question about whether Tillis could get enough for a runoff. What does this say? Does this election answer that question for you?
Well, it really didn't turn into the ideological battle that a lot of people had anticipated, and in part because I think the National Party decided that they had seen enough Tea Party losers nationally. They thought that perhaps that they had lost the United States Senate in 2010 and 2012 because Tea Party candidates were not ready for prime time and had lost in the general election. And they were determined to make Tillis the nominee and lined up all the National Party's powers like Right to Life and the Chamber and so forth to back him. I think it was very important and this was a very important victory for the party because Tillis, I think both Democrats and Republicans saw Tillis as the strongest possible candidate. I think you also have to understand, too, that the last five Senate primary runoffs in North Carolina, Democrat or Republican, the person who emerged from the runoff lost. So, so this was a very significant victory for the Republicans. We haven't had and it's very unusual for Republicans to have a runoff. There hadn't been a runoff since 1968. So it was a very important hump for the Republicans to get over. Tillis, it was a hard sell for Tillis. I mean, he should have – if you looked at his credentials, he had led the conservative revolution, as he put it, in the House. He should have been able to close the sale sooner. He had a little bit of the Romney problem that Mitt Romney had in 2012, without really the moderate record that Romney had. And he had, a hard time making this sale to a lot of conservative voters.
Well, Susan, I'll ask you and then I'll ask Michael the same question. Is this really a false dichotomy? I mean, a lot of people are saying, look, the Tea Party isn't losing traction. They have been quite successful at simply pushing the party to the right. So this dichotomy, the apparent dichotomy between establishment and Tea Party is a kind of a straw man. How do you feel about that?
Sure. I think that one of the places the Tea Party has been the most effective is moving the agenda. And I think they've been able to move the agenda even with issues that are not quite Tea Party issues, such as social conservative issues, access to abortion. But I think, too, the Tea Party has started to realize we may not be able to win these primaries as much as we could. But I think they're going out and trying to get voters to question the establishment politicians. The Tea Party, Greg Brannon, who ran against Tillis in the primary, was really a one note. He just pushed the Constitution chapter and verse against everything, and you just can't silly putty that into a general election. I think, too, the ideological component for Tillis is important, but the attention that the National Party has given, they really think that Kay Hagan is very vulnerable. And I think that when you look at what Tillis has done, people say that his record is more conservative, much more conservative than he let on during the primary, and that he didn't have to move himself further to the right to avoid a runoff, to have a runoff. But and they think that's important when it comes to November and Kay Hagan.
Michael, what do you think?
I would agree completely with Susan. I think where the Tea Party truly won was not necessarily maybe in their ideal candidate. Tom Tillis, according to some polls, certainly had the substantial plurality support of Tea Party self-identified individuals. But I think where the Tea Party has truly made the impact is indeed the policy movement within the Republican Party, pushing them to some key areas and key policy stances that I think Kay Hagan and certainly the Democrats and their surrogates will utilize. Things like the issue of Obamacare will be heavily battled by both sides, but things like the minimum wage. I think what we're going to find is a true proxy fight over a lot of policy issues that for Tillis and for the Republicans strongly adhere to the area of policy agreement that the Tea Party has occupied within the state GOP party.
Well, that raises the question of how things go in the general election. As you point out, Kay Hagan has been seen certainly by Republicans as vulnerable. There are polls that suggest that's true as well. And yet, Rob Christensen, as you know, in the last election, more North Carolinians at the national level voted for Democrats than Republicans. So how does this general election shape up?
Well, I think we could say a couple things about it. Is that in fact Hagan's numbers do indicate that she is very vulnerable, but that Tillis is not the strongest possible candidate either. So I think what we're looking at is an extremely expensive campaign. I think we're looking at a $40, $50 million campaign. I think we're looking at a very negative campaign. I don't think that either Hagan or Tillis have a particularly high profile with voters. I don't think voters know very much about either one of them. I think it's going to be an extremely negative campaign and with lots of third-party ads, which we've already seen, of course. And so I think there's going to be an effort to make by both sides to make the other candidate unacceptable. And so you'll vote for my guy or my gal because the other person is so unacceptable. And so I think we're in for a multi-million dollar mud bath in which the Obamacare and Obama will be tied around Kay Hagan's neck, and the legislature and voter ID and all those sorts of issues will be tied around Tillis's neck.
Yeah. So, yeah, you talked about that. I know, Susan, you're interested in this whole issue of money and super PAC money and outside money. I mean, what kind of effect will it have? We know it'll get expensive. Do voters care where the money's coming from? Tell us more about give us some thoughts on that.
Well, I think people had kind of written a postmortem from the super PAC after 2012. I think that was really mistaken. You can't underestimate what money can do in one single cycle. Kay Hagan has been running, or at least the Senate Majority PAC, ads during March Madness that were seen about who's the winner at the end, who are the finalists, and they were the Koch brothers. I'm skeptical that the voter really looks at those ads. We've become jaded. Yeah, there's a lot of money in politics. So I think that tact for her is not really going to work. I think the super PACs, the money that was spent was astounding. I agree with Rob. It's going to be maybe one of the most expensive races in the country. Usually you have to have that first round of ads that are bio ads and you introduce the candidate. Tillis had a few of those, but now people know who he is. They know who Kay Hagan is. And several years ago, if I'm correct, Tom Tillis did a kind of speaker's tour and went all around the state and had, like, here's what the North Carolina legislature is doing. That could work very well for him because people like to say, ask people in Iowa, they like to say, oh, I've met Tom Tillis. I like Tom Tillis. Well, I listened to what he had to say. So I think in addition to that, and one thing, too, I'd point out in case I don't get to it, the question of surrogates is very important. I don't know who Kay Hagan will have campaigning with her. I doubt very seriously it's President Obama. And I think Tom Tillis has a wealth of people to choose from.
Well, we'll talk more about that and other races that we haven't even touched on yet as our conversation continues with Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College, Michael Bitzer, a professor of political science at Catawba College, and Rob Christensen, chief political writer for The News and Observer. And just ahead, our political junkie Ken Rudin joins the conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking about primary elections yesterday. Rob Christensen, chief political writer for the News and Observer. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College. Susan Roberts, a professor of poli-sci at Davidson College. And before the break, we were talking about the impact of money. And one race where a lot of money was spent and the people who spent it didn't get their money's worth was the judicial primary, state Supreme Court race. Justice Robin Hudson was in the hot seat, and they spent a lot of money. There were negative ads that criticized her, and she managed to win and not be unseated. Rob Christensen, what do you make of that?
Well, there was, of course, a national group that came in and spent over $1 million in an ad that tied Supreme Court Justice Robin Hudson to a case, a child molestation case, and made her seem to be suggested that she was soft on child molestation. The idea was to knock her out because the primary is, in fact, nonpartisan and that the two top vote getters, regardless of political affiliation, would be in the fall. And so you had two essentially Republican candidates, and the idea was to knock her, for the Republicans, was to knock her out and with a very tough ad. And it was an extraordinarily tough ad. And a lot of money was spent, but it did not work. And I think the reason it did not work was because the ad was just too tough, too raw. And the fact of the matter is that North Carolina audiences are among the more sophisticated audiences when it comes to negative ads. So we've had negative ads going back to the 1980s with Jesse Helms. And so and we've been such a swing state that hardly any group of voters in the country have had seen more negative ads than North Carolina voters. And so you can just be too heavy-handed in ads. And I think this was just too heavy-handed. And voters looked at this ad and said, I don't think so. This just does not ring true. And so I also think that was also true for the ads that was run by the Political Action Committee associated with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid that went after Tom Tillis. Tried to knock down Tom Tillis in the Republican Senate primary. They were too heavy-handed as well. They tried to tie him into a sex scandal involving some aides. So I think what those judicial ads said was that you have to be fairly sophisticated in your approach, and you can be too heavy-handed. And I think those ads backfired.
Let's talk a little bit more about money. Our political junkie Ken Rudin joins us now. Hello, Ken.
if you want to vote for Clay Aiken, vote 1-800-555-1111.
And you get a tote bag from somebody, but not from us. Ken, we're talking about money here, the impact, and we talked about one case where, you know, money really didn't seem – there was a huge $1 million spent to try to unseat a sitting justice who was running for re-election. Didn't work. Walter Jones is another case where a lot of national money came in, a sitting, an incumbent Republican who had seen as anti-establishment because of he had crossed the leadership in Washington, and that didn't work. Tell us about that race.
Well, yes. I mean, you're picking a race where the money didn't work, but as you pointed out earlier, the money that was for Tom Tillis did make a big difference, and it got much more votes than the other two candidates, or the other seven candidates, I should say. But in the Walter Jones race, that was very interesting because usually we talk about the Tea Party outsiders challenging the Republican incumbent insiders, the establishment. Well, nobody can call Walter Jones an establishment figure. He's anti-war, anti-foreign aid. He's a Republican, but he called for the impeachment of President Bush. So he's pretty much different than most Republicans around the country. He's kind of a libertarian, and some mainstream Republicans will even call him a liberal, although he's hardly a liberal. But the point is, there was a lot of outside money coming into that race to defeat the incumbent congressman from the Republican establishment, from many Bush figures. Ari Fleischer tweeted about that. I really want Walter Jones beaten. That's the one he really wanted. So a lot of money came into it, and for no good.
Well, what do you think accounts for that? Incumbency? He's been there a long time?
He's been there a long time. Of course, his father was there. His father, the late Democrat Walter Jones, was in a similar, a nearby district for many, many years. He's been around a long time. And look, you know, whatever you think about his politics, first of all, one, the war is not popular. Two, Jones is known for constituent service, and he's been around for 20 years. And, you know, it's not that he voted one way differently than the many other Republican establishment folks. The point is that he just does his work, you know, responds to the constituents, and he has a reservoir of goodwill.
Let's talk about Renee Elmers in her primary battle. She was supposed to be vulnerable. She was under attack from the right, particularly her stand on immigration, where she talked about wanting a pathway to citizenship. That was supposed to make her vulnerable, and she won hands down.
She did, and it just shows that maybe it's not toxic to support an immigration overhaul. It may not be toxic to be close to the House leadership as Renee Elmers is. You know, of course, all the focus, and a lot of people were up very late waiting for Clay Aiken or Keith Crisco to emerge the winner. But ultimately, the second district, the Republican primary, was the big one because, you know, once upon a time, this was solid Democratic seat until Elmers won it in 2010. And now that it's been redistricted even more, it's obvious that whoever wins the primary there will be the congressperson elect. So both Renee Elmers and, in a sense, David Rauser in the 7th District both talked about changing the immigration laws. And, of course, you know, the Tea Party folks were yelling amnesty and talking about selling out principles. But she won. Now, she won by 59-41%, so you can make the case that Frank Roche, who was not that well-known, didn't have that much money, got 41%, and that's not a bad showing. But Renee Elmers also showed that you can talk about immigration and live for another day.
Well, and sticking with Elmers and Jones, I guess the idea that you can also buck the establishment in Washington and not necessarily lose a lot of votes, at least among the Republican faithful in North Carolina.
In North Carolina, that's true. That may not be the case in other states. And, of course, we have a lot of primaries to come. You know, starting this month, there'll be primaries every week. And there are a lot of instances where Tea Party folks are running against Republican incumbents, establishment incumbents, on issues such as immigration. And the Tea Party may find more success in other states than they found in North Carolina yesterday.
All right, Ken, I know you've got to go. And I just wonder if any of our panelists, Michael, I thought you might have had a question for Ken. And if you do, poor Ken's got to move on to other stations for other primaries. You know how it goes when you're a busy guy like Ken.
Exactly. Just a very quick question. Ken, what are your thoughts about how much outside money is going to come into North Carolina, particularly with the U.S. Senate race? Will that really dwarf what the candidates spend themselves on the race?
Oh, there's no question. And we've seen it throughout the whole primary as well. I mean, first of all, if you look at the states that have primary big Senate elections this year, New York, California, Texas, they're not competitive Senate races. As a matter of fact, New York and California don't even have Senate races. So North Carolina may be the biggest state to have a Senate race. The amount of money already poured in that's poured into North Carolina is the most being spent anywhere else. And as we saw with, you know, the Koch brothers and the Senate Majority Fund on behalf of Kay Hagan, there's going to be tons and tons of outside money, and for good reason. One, the Republicans see Kay Hagan as vulnerable. Two, they think it's a great opportunity for a pickup, and media is not that expensive in North Carolina comparative to other states. You're going to see tons of outside money. As Rob was talking about earlier, you guys are going to be bombarded, and a lot of them may not be from Tillis or Hagan. They will be from outside groups, and you're not going to be able to turn on your TV without seeing a commercial one way or the other.
So avoid the mess, read the newspaper, and listen to public radio. That's my advice.
Do I have time for one question? I don't have time for one question.
You do, Susan. Susan Roberts.
Well, as we were talking about, turnout is essential to Kay Hagan. She might have been a coattail candidate in 2008 with Obama's popularity and kind of star quality. What will the Voting Rights Act changes, some of which are confusing, some that call them ballot suppression, some that say ballot security, what will that do if we think turnout is a real consideration for Hagan? Will that be a question in the fall or one that we can even track?
Well, it's the kind of issue that could perhaps inspire the Democratic base, and that's what they're hoping for. Obviously, we've seen two different North Carolinas in the last couple of years. 2008, we saw Barack Obama and Kay Hagan winning, and in 2012, we saw a Republican governor, Pat McCrory, winning and Mitt Romney winning North Carolina. The question is, which state, which North Carolina do we see in 2014? But there are a lot of issues. Look, Kay Hagan could run away from the Affordable Care Act all she wants. It will be a key issue in November. The Republicans are confident it will be a key issue. And what the Democrats are going to try to push forward or point out to is that voting rights and women's reproductive rights are key issues. And hopefully that will bring the base back, because we know that there's going to be a significant Democratic turnoff from what we saw in 2012 compared to 2014.
All right. Political junkie Ken Rudin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
And we continue our conversation about the primaries on the state of the. I want to stick with this question of turnout, because if you talk to Democrats and you talk about gerrymandering and safe seats, and you know, if you ask Democratic strategists, what do you do now? They'll tell you there's no such thing as a safe seat, particularly when you look at these historically low turnouts. That what it's incumbent on Democrats to do is to turn out record numbers of voters, and that can flip a seat no matter how safe it seems. And I just wonder what each of you thinks about that, Michael.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on that, because what we're going to see is very different from what we saw in 2012. In terms of presidential elections, registered Republicans casting ballots typically make up about 33% of those folks who show up in a presidential year. When you go into a midterm congressional year like in 2010, that number jumps from a third of the electorate to almost 37-38% of all voters casting will come from registered Republicans. And what we know from exit polls is that if you self-identify as a Republican, you're going to vote 95% of the time for Republican candidates. So already we're dealing with an electorate that will be skewed to the right, to the Republicans. My estimation of this fall is it's going to be a critical base election. You can't count on unaffiliated voters, even though they're over a quarter of the registered pool, to show up in these elections. So what the Hagan and Democratic campaigns have to do is to boost their Democratic registered voters, even though some of them may be still those conservative Democrats. They have to bump up their numbers, particularly in urban areas, to compensate. And so I think that's where the base election year is really going to be held in terms of the ground war in North Carolina this fall.
Well, Susan, let me ask you to answer your own question about that very, you know, about those very issues. Are the issues that have arisen around the state legislature this year, voter ID and some of the other issues, abortion clinics and all of those kinds of, not to mention teacher pay, is that going to be the kind of thing that can spark greater voter registration, or will it kind of be business as usual, do you think?
No, I think it can spark greater voter registration. Also throw in there with North Carolina's the legislature's recent fascination with abandoning the Common Core for educational standards that are more in line with North Carolina. I think unmarried women might be the key when you look at questions of access to abortion. One thing that was very curious to me is last year or the year before, Tom Tillis helped get past the reparations for victims of sterilization that were still surviving. And that was one that had kind of a, you know, feminist would say that's a good thing. I also think I want to follow up one moment on what Michael said, is that any effort to persuade independent voters in 2014, you're not spending your money wisely. Even the leaners of the independents, those people might not turn out in the midterm. So I think looking at the independent voters, you don't really want to capture their vote because they're not voting.
Rob?
Well, I think there is at least the possibility that when you think about the whole Moral Monday movement, that this could be at least has the potential to be the Democrats' Tea Party movement, right? One of the most important driving factors in politics is anger. I mean, it was anger that led to the Tea Party movement. It was anger about Obama and Obamacare, right? And there's and if you just measure things like intensity in terms of whether it's phone calls and emails that I get as a reporter and a columnist, or just seeing in people and just the conversation you get from people. There's a tremendous amount of intensity right now among the Democratic side about what's going on in this state. Now, the question is, does that translate into the voter booth? And we don't know that. But there's at least that possibility. So if there is a if there was a Republican backlash against President Obama and his agenda, the question is there going to be a Democratic backlash against the Republican legislature? And this, and with Tom Tillis, this is the first time that somebody who is a leader of the legislature is going to face a statewide vote.
The other hope, I guess, that Democrats would express would that there would be this ideological split in the party. That seems to have healed. And you wrote about this Sunday, Rob, in the NNO, in a column where you talked about a couple of things that are a little bit different this time around. There was a revolution in the Republican Party in 1980, outsiders versus insiders. But that split is different this time around. And then another analysis that, in fact, the party might be becoming more mature. So to talk about those kinds of ways of looking at what's happening in the Republican Party.
Well, the party went through some terrific ideological battles in the 70s and 80s. And that was essentially when the party started out as kind of a moderate mountain chamber of commerce party under leadership of people like Jim Holzhauser and Jim Broyhill, who were governor and congressman and so forth. And you saw the rise of a very conservative party under Jesse Helms, which later ends in the battle. The major moment was in 1976 when you had Gerald Ford, the unelected president, facing a challenge from Ronald Reagan, and North Carolina put Reagan, elected Reagan. It was the first time ever in American history that a sitting president was defeated in a presidential primary. And this was just tore the party apart. So when you talk about these ideological battles today, they are really pale imitations of the kind of ideological battles. I mean, that battle's really been decided. The party is now the party of Reagan, and it's much more conservative. You know, I like to tell the story about 1988, where actually the battles actually became a physical riot, essentially. This was a 4th District Republican convention at the National Guard Armory in Lewisburg, and you had the Bush Republicans were running it, and the Pat Robertson insurgents didn't like the way that was being run, and they essentially got down the back of the armory, got down the knees, prayed, sang "Onward, Christian Soldiers," and charged the front of the armory. And there were like dozens of fistfights, and it made national news. So it was an actual brawl. They had to call the police to break up. So it was that kind of intensity, and there's not that kind of intensity today. And in part, and it's because the party has matured, and it's able to. I think able to get these various strains within the party, and you know, the party right now, if you look at some of the polls, it is the Tea Party is an integral part of the Republican Party. The evangelicals are an integral part of the Republican Party. These are not wings of the party. These are this is part of the heart and soul of what the Republican Party is today.
I wonder if this is going to have any impact on the upcoming short session. The legislature meets in a couple of weeks, and there will be a session. Tom Tillis, Speaker of the House, he knows what the record is to date. He doesn't know what's going to happen in the next few weeks. What impact do you think these elections might have on the short session, if any? Susan, let me start with you.
Well, I think one thing he's not going to bring up or move, and this would just be to create something out of thin air, but we all agreed that his answer on climate change in the first debate was one that he might live to regret. I do think the Common Core, it's going to come up, and I think this may really divide even some Republicans because it doesn't have widespread partisan division right now. I think it will get that. And I also think that if he's savvy, which he is, he was on MSNBC today and he was very good avoiding some tough questions from Chuck Todd. I think that he will keep activity to a minimum if he can at all.
Michael Bitzer, next week's short session, what do you think?
I think the key is going to be how short will the short session be. And one of the key things that I'll be looking for, and we heard from the governor today with his announcement on teacher pay, is can potentially the Republicans seek to defuse that particular issue that the Democrats will definitely use in terms of teacher pay, and how do we, you know, basically get that issue off the table in terms of a general fall campaign issue.
Rob Christensen, a short answer about the short session?
Well, I think it's problematic that he's actually Speaker and running as a candidate. It means he can't be out there campaigning and raising money, and it also gives him all these potential pitfalls.
We will see. Thank you all very much. Rob Christensen, chief political writer for the News and Observer. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College. Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up next, a novel about a French athlete turned Nazi collaborator. Stay tuned to the State of Things.